This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik, joined in the studio today by Lee Chui Lin. The Women's Aid Organization, or WAO, is hosting a series of four gender equality talks in conjunction with the worldwide 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. And here to tell us more about this campaign is WAO's advocacy manager, Yuren Chung. And joining him is Melissa Mohamed Akhir, senior advocacy officer at the Women's Center for Change in Penang. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So good to have you guys here, especially you, Ren Chong, who I think you were a regular and then you've been away for a while. What have you been up to?
Well, I was away for 1 year, completing my master's degree in public policy in the UK. And subsequent to that, I came back and resumed my work with Women's Aid Organization.
I mean, you're here today to talk in particular about this campaign that the WAO is championing. 16 Days of Activism. Tell us more about that.
So the 16 Days of Activism really is, it's a global campaign. And the idea really is, you know, let's all take this time together as a global community to galvanize against violence against women and violence against children. So every year there's a theme for 16 Days globally. And this year, actually, the theme is to raise funds to combat violence against women and children. In Malaysia, we're sort of following our own theme and really just focusing on gender equality. And the two issues that we're looking at are first, domestic abuse, domestic violence, and secondly, discrimination in the workplace.
What's the history of this campaign and why 16 days?
So the significance of this campaign really is that, you know, is violence against women a priority or not? And the idea is that it's always an issue. You know, we've seen time and again, it's an issue that people think are important, people say are important, but never really do anything about it. It's always, something's always a bigger priority. So the idea behind 16 days, which was started in a university in the United States, was really to just say, look, you know, for these 16 days, let's put in a bit extra as a global community to actually do the things that we said we wanted to do. It culminates on the 10th of December, which is Human Rights Day.
One of the things that struck me when you were speaking just then is whenever people talk about, you know, 16 days of awareness, etc., one of the main things, you know, we always talk about is let's raise awareness, let's raise knowledge, let's raise funds is quite something else entirely. How much money do we really need in order to combat this effectively, and where would the money be going? I mean, obviously not necessarily just here in Malaysia, but when we say we're raising funds, why for?
So I think combating violence against women is something that you know, requires resources. So, you know, for example, shelters for women in crisis who just need a place to stay for you know, a few nights or a few weeks when they face violence at home. That's one area. Another area is providing health services, for example, for rape survivors and survivors of sexual assault. Hospitals need to be equipped with resources to operate. In Malaysia, we have one-stop crisis centres supposedly in all government hospitals. That's another example where resources are required. So that's one chunk in terms of providing services, be it from the NGO side or from the government side. Another area that requires a lot of resources is enforcing laws and policies. You know, we can have really, really amazing laws, but if the resources are not allocated to, for example, training enforcement officers, training legal officers, doing some monitoring to ensure that laws and policies are being implemented as they should, then laws really are just a piece of paper. So I think in all these aspects, either providing services, ensuring enforcement is doing well, as two areas, and of course as the area of promotion. So a lot of this is about changing mindsets, and if we can, the more we can reach people, the more we can communicate with people that to say that, you know, violence against women, violence against children, that's wrong, and here's what you can do, here's what your rights are. I think the more we can actually stop this violence, and that itself requires resources.
And let's not forget who's at the center of all the work that we're doing is the survivor. So it's not a one-off incident of violence. from the incident itself, like what Renchu mentioned, going to the hospital, then you're dealing with the police, then you're dealing with the welfare, then you're dealing with the courts, which may take years, and the prosecutors. And then after that, how about the healing process? How about the recovery and the treatment? So all this taking years, if you can count the cost of that, that is where the money is going to.
So the series of talks that the WAO has put together started on November 16, every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. And I can't help but notice that the time is not very conducive for many people to go to. Why was it Wednesday at 1 p.m.?
Sure. Just a quick point on the previous issue, but a previous point on funding. So feel free to go to WAO's website or WCC's website and donate to us because we do provide these kind of services that we mentioned just now. Okay, so on the question of the gender equality talks, what we really wanted to do was reach out to those segment of working people, in particular working women, who may not have the time to come on the weekends or you know even after work, but they could maybe spend some time during lunch hour, and you know we do provide refreshments and snacks at the talks, and people can sort of bring their lunch as well. And so the idea is really, you know, if someone's super busy and, you know, they have responsibilities that they have to do on the weekend and after work, maybe this is a time where they can spare just 1 hour to come and learn about issue, come and contribute to the discussion and come and learn, you know, for themselves what rights they have, what they can do.
We've had two talks. The first, from what I understand, was on intervening in domestic violence, and we had survivor Fadila Niza who spoke. Could you tell us a little bit more about Fadila and what she went through?
Absolutely. So Fadila is an amazing individual. She was inflicted with emotional and financial abuse throughout her marriage, and eventually it turned into physical abuse. So she was actually abused in front of her children's kindergarten, so in public, by her then husband. And she's shared this story. She's bravely contributed this story in many forums. But when she was when she received that abuse at the kindergarten, one thing that struck her was that no one really helped her. There were people around, but no one stopped her then husband.
No one stepped in.
No one stepped up. And she had a broken nose as a result of that assault, and she had to go to the hospital by herself. And so she stood up for herself. She received support from WAO to go through the investigative process, the legal process, and the emotional process. And now, interestingly, and very commendably, she's standing up not just for herself but for others as well. She's actually started her own organization called the Johor Empowerment of Intellectual Women Association, JEIWA, to help other women in her who have faced similar experiences to her in Johor to actually escape violence, domestic violence. And so the takeaway here, really, I think we can learn a lot from Fadila is that, you know, first, you know, we shouldn't be bystanders. We should be upstanders in the sense that if we witness violence in the public sphere or in our homes or at work, let's do something about it. Let's not leave people, survivors like Fadila to fend for herself, you know, and go to hospital by herself without anyone even intervening.
But the reason why people don't do that, and of course this is no excuse, but I think the most commonly stated reason is, well, you know, it's someone else's household, it's happening, you know, inside a house, it's their private lives, I don't want to step in. Or you just feel that, look, it's a private thing, I have no right. Or sometimes you're worried that the aggressor might turn against you. I mean, these are all the fears that people have. I mean, how would you address that?
Safety is a valid concern, and we don't advise people to intervene without making sure the situation, as in they've got backup. So even though there are campaigns like ring the bell or knock on the door when you hear the violence from the neighbor's house, when you go with backup, that can actually stop the violence. And that's where the conversation is about violence is a private matter or is it a crime? So when something is a crime, you can't just close a blind eye. But you can pursue safety measures so that when you intervene, you're safe. You'd be surprised. You can find housewives, grandmothers who have intervened because they understand that it's wrong. And we've had violence that are done in public spaces where it's really an old auntie who's shouting or doing something. There's many things you can do, and you can choose to be safe in the meantime, but please do something. Because the survivor shouldn't be alone, shouldn't be going through the violence alone.
Is it the place for a bystander to make a police phone call, for example?
Yes, I think really there are maybe generally three things that someone can do. So first is just intervene. I think, so for example, just say, hey, what's going on? Or even just like knocking on the door and interrupting the violence just to let the perpetrator know that they're being watched. So that's kind of a less intrusive way of getting involved. The second is really to provide the person being abused, the survivor, with information. So for example, if it's your neighbor, you could pass this person WS hotline number or the government's hotline number, for example, and that person themselves can, when they're ready, take action. And then the third is what you described, which is call the police. Because at the end of the day, domestic violence is a crime. And if you see someone, your neighbor's car being stolen or someone breaking into your neighbor's house, you would probably call the police.
Yeah.
So in this situation, it's the same. If you see something going, if you suspect something going on, you're entitled to call the police.
From a purely social perspective, though, there are also going to be people who fear even being told off. I can imagine, you don't want to give, for example, the WA or the WCC's number because you're worried that the wife or the woman herself will say, this is not your business. I don't want to talk to you anymore, for example. And that's, you read about responses like that in cases of abuse as well. How do you kind of push past through, never mind your safety, just the awkwardness, the social mores that tell us this is not where we should go?
Okay. So there's many, many stages of being a survivor. So post-trauma, you might be in denial. You might not be ready to take the next step. So I understand where you're coming from. Maybe a friend has been told off. But when you're a friend, and we've had many, many cases where friends have stepped up and probably saved their friends' lives by offering that, when you're ready, I'm here. Friends have driven their friends to hospitals when the situation happens, even though before that you were told off. So when necessary, you're there to provide the support system. Because in many, many situations, we have seen survivors of domestic violence, sometimes they don't have that close network with their families, for example, because of the marital domestic situations. So, or sometimes there's shame. You think it's your own fault. So you don't want to tell your friend. But when you observe, when you observe situations where your friend may need help, be ready and you can tell her that I'm here for you. So all the steps that Rancho mentioned earlier, maybe information, quietly, you just provide the number. When she's ready, she may take the step forward.
On the show today is Yuren Chung, Advocacy Manager at the Women's Aid Organization, and Melissa Mohamed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at the Women's Center for Change. We're talking about this campaign to raise awareness about gender equality in conjunction with the worldwide 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. Up next, we'll talk more about the process of seeking justice for domestic violence. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik, joined today by Lee Tree Lin. In the studio with me is Yuren Chung, Advocacy Manager from the Women's Aid Organization, and Melissa Mohamed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer from the Women's Center for Change. We've been talking about this campaign to raise gender equality. This is in conjunction with the worldwide 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. So before we went off the break, we were talking about the first talk that went on in this series of talks that WAO has put together. The second one was about seeking justice for domestic violence. And Rin Chung, you spoke at this talk. Could you give us a summary of what was covered?
Absolutely. So we were quite lucky to be joined by ASB Elia Ulfa, who is an officer with the police headquarters, specifically with the unit that deals with sexual violence and crimes against children. So really, ASP Elia took us through the process of what rights can a survivor get from the police specifically, and that's protection. So she went through the process of how does a survivor get a protection order? So that there are two orders that a survivor can get. One is called the interim protection order, and that's something that survivor can get pretty quickly when violence is reported, and that document itself will protect the survivor from further violence. And then the second is called just a protection order, and that's something that is received in once the case has gone to court. And really, I think what was so important about that talk was that it was really a chance for D11, for the police and the public to directly engage. You know, so there were survivors who came to the talk and they were able to ask the police officer exactly what they can get and sort of explain to them what happened in reality. And it was a chance also for the police on the police side to give their feedback to these survivors directly. So I think that was something that was quite quite interesting.
Whenever we talk about justice or even just coming forward, sadly, and this is not unique to Malaysia, we live in a world in which the burden of proof lies on the person or the person who has suffered the violence. You know, it lies on the person to say, well, I can tell you on this date, this date, this date, this date, I recorded it, I have, you know, I have the marks to show for it. Of course, that in an ideal world, that would not be the case, but this is the world in which we live. So when one is finding themselves a victim of domestic violence, what are the things you need to kind of start documenting, keeping in mind in order to come forward and be, you know, and have the most, I guess, productive outcome?
Yeah. So you're very right in that proving a case, you wouldn't usually have perfect cases with real clear injuries and there are witnesses.
And a timeline, yeah.
Yeah, to the actual situation. We only, unfortunately, the only cases that we have where evidence is so clear is where the children witness the violence itself and the children become the star witnesses because their mom has died from the violence. So we have a few cases like that. But the majority of cases is one against one. So you may have some injuries. You may have bruises if it's physical abuse. That you must record immediately. Everyone has a phone. Try and take photographs. Because we also have seen cases where due to delay, the police did not record the injuries. So it's not so clear. So even though the words of a survivor actually, in theory, can be taken as evidence, what you say in court is evidence. However, because judges and all the parties in court are also human, sometimes when they see something, it's clearer. Okay, so take a photo. And on your own, we also call this writing down a diary or a chronology. On your own, write down what has happened. Keep that. Because particularly traumatizing situations, you may forget things. It's okay. So take your time and write it down. And when you remember, you can get back to the police and give them the information. If you've been hit on the head, nobody expects you to remember 100% of the evidence. And the trial may come 2 years after. Yeah, so you need some time. So record it down. But other than that, any other person you've spoken to, who is the first person you spoke to? So that person is usually the other witness. So that can be your friend who drove you to the hospital. Again, I'm still talking about physical injuries. If we're talking about psychological impact and all that, you need further referrals. It can't be seen on your body, but your trauma might be really high. So you have to speak to a counselor or a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist. So there are other ways to assess the mental state. Again, we clearly say it's not that you're not crazy. You just suffered mental trauma. So similar to if you've been hurt physically. It's just a recording of the injury that you have suffered. So with this actually theoretically in court, things should be moving forward in a prosecution. The problem we have is when there's prejudgment. Yeah, so there's victim blaming. So that one we still have to change through the gender sensitivity training, professionalism has to be upkept, stuff like that. Domestic violence is still largely seen as a domestic matter, not seen as a crime. So when we say it's a crime, so the orders itself, when someone does a further violence, you breach that order. It's not just a piece of paper. It is another crime. So this is where we have a big way to catch up, but there are good instances of best practices that we are seeing.
Staying on the topic of domestic violence, marital rape is something that Malaysia still does not recognise. In your line of work, and I'm wondering whether this was something that was raised in that session with ASP earlier, is it something that you come across a lot?
So it's definitely something that is always in conversation, in our conversation with authorities and lawmakers. And for us, definitely we want to see, we think, you know, rape is rape. Doesn't matter if you're married or not. You know, if just because you're married doesn't mean that you can steal from your spouse, right? So why is it when you're married, suddenly no doesn't mean no? So that's, I think, a strong point that we want to make. Of course, there is some protection in terms of when a spouse commits a rape. And that is basically the fear of harm or actual harm that's inflicted in the process of having sex. That is actually criminalized. So obviously we think that's not enough because there are ways that you can coerce without causing harm or fear of harm. The penalties in terms of imprisonment is lower, and it doesn't send the right message in terms of what is right and what is wrong. So it's definitely something that's always on top of our mind, and we always want to raise with authorities. That being said, even in the Domestic Violence Act, there are sexual violence is covered. So while it's not adequate, but it's still something that you can receive some protection from the law.
Yeah, latching on to what Ren Chung said, because you have to remember there would be injury suffered. It doesn't matter if you use coercion or just other forms of intimidation to cause the rape. It's actually still rape. So when there are injuries suffered, we can't say because you have a ring on your finger, it's excused. So in the scope of domestic violence, it's still considered as one of the categories of domestic violence.
We've also seen some news this week. This Wednesday, Nur Fadila Ahmad Saikin, who won a landmark court case on pregnancy discrimination, will be speaking about her experience. Can you briefly remind us about the details of what happened in that?
So this is a landmark case. And we commend Nur Fadila Ahmad Saikin for going through with this case. And because of that, she's created a very important precedent. So in terms of the background of the case, in 2008, Nur Fadila applied to work as a temporary teacher with the government. The next year, she was then offered that position, so she got the job and was given a memo confirming that she had received the job. And then something very disturbing happened. She was called to a taklimat, and where the government was about to give the contract to the people who already were accepted as teachers. And then they asked, who here is pregnant? So Nur Fadila, along with two other women, said that, yes, they were pregnant. And at that spot, their offer was taken back from them. So, this is something that really affected Nur Fadila. And she then took this issue to court. She basically sued the government, saying that she was discriminated based on her gender. And she won. She won, and she was awarded damages. So that's sort of the first part of the story. And as you know, there have been several appeals to the case. The government in 2013 indicated they would want to appeal the decision. Thankfully, they withdrew that, but they still appealed the damages. So how much damages was awarded. And on that basis, the court actually reduced the damages. But the latest development is, after Nur Fadila made another appeal, they've actually increased the damages back, not to how high it was initially, but to a slightly higher amount than was given after that.
So throughout this process, what were the ramification of her case, is it still early to feel its impact?
So this is an extremely important case, and basically what this means is that Malaysian citizens can be awarded damages for a breach of their constitutional rights. So if you look at the federal constitution, it enumerates a number of constitutional rights. And if any of that those rights are breached, the individual can actually receive damages.
And we're looking in terms of gender equality, it's matching to the lived realities of that particular woman. So here, how many pregnant women do we have in Malaysia who have to work, right? So the realities of a woman who is also pregnant and has to go to work, and for her to win means that she has been given a right to perform as an individual member of society. So there's no reasoning saying that she can't work or she's depriving the workforce because she got pregnant. So her rights are recognized, and this could be the way forward for everyone else with those same realities.
So considering that a recent survey by WAO found that 4 in 10 pregnant women have experienced discrimination at work, are we suggesting then that 4 in 10 kind of take things forward? Or, you know, are there other ways to kind of manage discrimination at this point in time?
So I think what Nofadila's case made possible now is that these women who are in similar situations to Nofadila, where they where the employer is a public institution, they can actually go to court and they can get remedies in the court.
And if we're taking this forward, the terms of your contract, your working conditions. So employees, the right to employment and working conditions that are suitable. Yeah. So your employer cannot use the argument that because you're pregnant, you're less of a worker compared to other people. So you, this can really be an exciting area to be explored on workers' rights, on whether the terms of the contract are fair. Because it's not, equality doesn't mean one size fits all. Equality means it must apply on equal opportunity, equal access, and equal impact. So in that sense, maybe people can take this forward to get better working relationships and better working conditions. So whether it's in the form of legal action or otherwise, or better negotiations with your employers within trade unions, who knows? But we're quite excited about this development.
So the series of talks by WAO will conclude on December 7th with WAO's Executive Director Sumitra Visvanathan, who will be speaking on the topic of sexual harassment at work. And this is also another issue which recently won a landmark ruling. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. Just to go back to the Nofadila case for a while. So if anyone is keen, especially particularly lawyers who are interested in the case or women who are facing similar experiences to Nofadila, do drop by to our talk this Wednesday, 30 November, 1 p.m., 1 to 2 p.m. at Ruang by Think City. It's really near the Masjid Jamek LRT. So you can go to our Facebook, Women's Aid Organization's Facebook, or our website to get more information on that. So on the area of sexual harassment, yes, you're absolutely right. We've also had some very positive developments on this issue in the courts. Essentially, it was a case involving two employees at Tabung Haji, where it's a very interesting case. And it's really one of those things where you feel like justice somewhat has been served. Because what happened was the male employee actually... He was the one accused of sexually harassing the woman employee. He got a slap on the wrist from the company. And because of that, he felt that he was being defamed. So he sued, actually. He sued this woman in court. So what the courts did was actually say, look, you actually, the man was actually in the wrong, and we're going to introduce this thing called a tort of sexual harassment, meaning between two private actors, one person can sue the other person for damages if they've been sexually harassed. And they awarded... they decided in favor of the woman employee.
So, because when we say the word tort, it's actually a wrong. So one person committed a wrong to another. It's very significant that the court recognized one, sexual harassment is a wrong. You can't sexually harass someone else in court. And two, they recognize that the person wronged has rights. So in the remarks that the court made, they did say that Malaysia has to develop further regarding this, have stronger laws, because currently we have codes, sexual harassment codes or guidelines. We have a little bit in our Employment Act, but it's not really clear, especially on remedies, meaning you've been sexually harassed. What do you get after that? How is it addressed by your employers? Or does everyone side with the harasser? And do you get remedies such as money? Is there compensation? So these are things that seem to be in principle affirmed in this case. So maybe we can have further developments and clearer codes of conduct or even clearer laws, because sexual harassment is actually a crime.
Yeah, and just to note, this is something that the women's groups have been working on with the Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, and it's something that the ministry has taken on as one of the reforms that they want to introduce, and so we're quite pleased to work with the ministry on that.
Mm. That's a very good positive note to end on. I think we've made a lot of social progress. So just to remind our listeners, the talk that will be happening this Wednesday, 30th of November, 1 p.m. at Ruang Think City. And the topic of the discussion is...
It'll be Respect My Bump, Pregnancy Discrimination, featuring the Noor Fadila Ahmad Saikin. So we urge you to attend. And the next week's one, on 7 December, is featuring our very own Executive Director of Women's Aid Organisation, Sumitra Viswanathan.
And just to plug BFM podcast as well, we've covered those two landmark cases in the past as well. If you'd like to listen to that interviews, you can go on to bfm.my/learn and search for landmark rulings on sexual harassment and gender discrimination. Ren Chung and Melissa, thank you very much for coming on the show. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.